This is Tree Stromer, and today is February 20th. I'm in Jamestown, North Carolina. This is an oral history interview for the Women's Veterans Historical Project at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And I have Amy Corning with me. Amy, could you state your name the way that you would like it to be on your collection?
Sure. Amy Sarvis Corning.
Okay, great.
Amy Sarvis Corning.
Okay, let's see how that goes. All right, Amy, well, why don't we go ahead and start out with where and when you were born?
Hey, I was born in Miami, Florida, 1957, a very, very hot July.
Hot July day. Was it the city of Miami that you lived in?
North Miami.
North Miami, okay. What did your folks do?
My father had formerly been in the Navy and had worked supply in the Navy. So when he got out, he worked motor parts for Motor Parts Corporation and drove taxis at night. My mother was a nurse, and she kind of worked sporadically because she was raising the children.
So how many brothers and sisters did you have?
One older sister and one younger brother.
Older sister and a younger brother?
Mm-hmm.
So you're in the middle, huh?
I'm in the middle.
Okay.
So my sister was 10 years older, so I'm still an older child.
Yeah. Okay. Well, how about in Miami? What was it like growing up there? Do you remember what you did as a kid for games or anything?
I remember riding my bicycle a lot. We went for walks and rode bicycles, and our next door neighbor had a swimming pool, so we were over at her house a lot in the swimming pool. I actually left Miami. We moved away when I was 7.
Oh, okay.
So not a whole lot of memories there, except for, and going to the beach. We went to the beach every single weekend, probably 10 months out of the year.
Do you remember whether you liked that or not as a kid?
I did. I got sunburned every time and didn't like it when the man-o-wars came and jellyfish came up because I would, couldn't leave them alone. So I would inevitably wind up with stings on my legs and arms and stuff, so.
Yeah. Well, so you moved away when you were 7. Where did you move to?
We moved to North Florida, which was my mother's hometown, which is where I consider my hometown. Grew up in Monticello, Florida, very close to Tallahassee, just south of the Georgia border.
Is that right?
So,
okay. How was that growing up? That was a little bit more rural area then.
Very rural, very agricultural. The town is known as the watermelon seed capital of the world. So we grew up with watermelon festivals and going out and harvesting watermelon and corn and things along those lines.
Yeah. So you had a lot of watermelon growing up?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you still like to eat watermelon?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, sometimes if you're around it a lot, you know.
No, there's nothing better than a good watermelon.
Well, you can probably pick out a good one, too. Huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah, a good thump or something?
Yes. Yes. Some people have other ways to do it, but no, my grandfather taught me to thump the watermelon and get the ones that sound hollow.
Yeah, that's right. Now, so you're in a more rural area. What kind of things do you guys do for fun?
We had lots and lots and lots of animals. Our house, it wasn't a farm, but if you looked at the amount of pets and things that we had, we raised ducks and chickens and at one time had a horse and rabbits and all sorts of stuff. So my brother and I were taught responsibility very, very young. It was our job to get up and go feed all the animals and water them before we went to school and still get dressed and get out to the school bus on time. And things along those lines. And then as soon as we came home from school, you went back out and fed and watered everything again. So I liked it. The animals were my best friends. So, but my best girlfriend lived next door, grew up with her and her brothers and stuff. So we would play pickup football games or basketball games and things like that. So while I don't remember a whole lot of playing, I think growing up was pretty much okay.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Now, how did you get to school?
Usually, my mother and father had divorced, and my mother had remarried My stepfather was a barber in town. So while we did ride the bus occasionally, and we certainly rode the bus to get home, but my stepfather, we'd ride into town with him because he had to open up the barber shop 10 minutes before school started. So he would just drop us off at the school on his way to the barber shop.
Okay. So how did you like school? What was it like?
I always liked school. I knew at the age of 12 I wanted to be a school teacher when I grew up. School was it was just the place to be. I had friends that I enjoyed being around. I always emulated my teachers. They were almost all the teachers that I had were really, really good teachers, good role models. And I was that kid who always would stay after school and clean the blackboard and all that kind of stuff. Not that anyone knows what a blackboard is anymore.
Some people might still have an idea.
So, no, I loved school. Social outlet, a place to focus. I did really, learning came easy for me, so I did really well in school.
Did you have a favorite subject?
Probably English. Did not care for the sciences so much. Tolerated those, but yeah, probably more the touchy-feely subjects that maybe subjects that I could exaggerate in and get away with it.
For writing? Like,
right.
When you had to do writing and things like that, yeah. What about, now, trying to figure out what years this would be. So were the schools still segregated at all where you were, or were they integrated?
Integration came when I was in eighth grade.
Okay.
So I had grown up in the same elementary school that my mother had gone to. All of my family had gone to. My brother came up through the same elementary school, but in middle school, that's when they integrated, and we were, the middle school then was at what had been a traditionally black school. I personally liked the way the school was set up, but that first year had a lot of bumps in it. There were a couple of episodes of violence, and my grandfather came and picked us up and took us home early on a couple of days, and teachers got hurt. But that probably lasted about a week, and I have no idea what set it off. And just some of my best friends were black, and we kind of stopped noticing the difference. It was more our parents that noticed the difference.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So, but I was only in that school for 1 year because the high school was at the school that was had been traditionally white, so I was right back over at the high school the next year, only because I progressed in years.
What were the names of your, do you remember the name of your elementary school?
The elementary school was Jefferson Elementary. The middle school at that time was Howard Middle School. It had been Howard Academy. And then the high school was Jefferson High School.
Now you said that you always, since you were 12, you wanted to be a teacher. did you feel, well, how did you feel as a girl in your expectations for the things that you could do, when you became an adult? Did you have any sense of what you could possibly do that was out there for you, opportunities?
No, I think growing up, especially in the town that I grew up in, we weren't necessarily introduced to a whole lot of things that were out there. There were subjects that you could major in college that, until I went to college, I never knew those subjects existed. And maybe that was because I always wanted to be a teacher, so I was going to grow up and go to college and major in education or English and just go on from there. So I never even thought about it. But when my husband and I both went to college and found out that there were actually areas of study such as forestry and biology and things along those lines, we'd never even conceived of those types of subjects. So,
but you had an idea that you were going to go to college.
Oh, that was always expected.
Yeah.
I grew up, that was an expectation. Yeah. My sister graduated from high school, went right into college. that was an automatic expectation. And my grandfather had put away money for all of us to go to school.
Excellent. Well, do you have any memories that you want to share from your high school days at all? Anything that you can recall that...
Well, it was interesting that later I did wind up going into the military because we did not have any type of military affiliation at our school whatsoever. And my senior year, someone came in and offered the AFOQT, the officer qualifying test, and then took a poll of the students to ask if it were offered, would we be interested in taking military classes while in high school? And I had said yes, but it never came to any kind of fruition or anything. And yet later, that's exactly the direction I went into. That was a fluke. It was very interesting that they asked my senior year, because as far as I know, that they'd never asked at the high school. And my high school does have Air Force and Army ROTC now.
Oh, the one that you went to when mm-hmm. you were younger. Okay. Okay, so now you graduate from high school, and then what?
By the time I approached graduation, I was already engaged to get married. So I got married in October after high school, worked two jobs that summer to save up money and everything. My husband was in the military. He was in the Marine Corps at the time. And he did his first enlistment and went ahead and got out. Felt like the Marine Corps had been very, very good for him, but it was not going to offer him anything further that he could use. He kicks himself now because, of course, he could have been retired 10 years ago. But the benefit of that was that he got the GI Bill. And we got married in October. He finished his enlistment, and we briefly moved back to my hometown. But it's a small town, and if you don't have a degree, if you don't have a specialty, there's not a whole lot waiting for young people there. So eventually we moved back up to where my husband was from in New Hampshire. And we're doing odd jobs. I was working at Dunkin' Donuts, and he had the GI Bill and decided to go take a college class. It worked. He got an A in it. He felt like, okay, this isn't so hard. Took two more classes, and at that point I started feeling frustration, because obviously when I got married I did not go to college. And I was always the one who was supposed to go to college, and now he was going to college. A friend of mine that I was working with at Dunkin' Donuts came in one day, and I was tutoring her in Spanish. And she said, I've talked to my dad, and if you want to go to college, he'll pay for your college education.
This is a friend of yours? No?
Yes. At that point, we had a baby. And the thought of going to school full-time with a baby was very interesting. But I kind of needed somebody to tell me that. Now, he never paid for any of my college education. But it was just the fact that without even knowing me, somebody was expressing that kind of confidence that I could do it.
Give me a little nudge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I went home and told my husband, I think we ought to both go to school full-time. So we both left our jobs behind and applied for, you know, financial aid and grants and everything we could get. And he started using the GI Bill, and we both went through college full time with a baby.
Together.
So I look back on it now. By the time I graduated, I swore I'd never set foot inside a classroom again because trying to manage schedules, it was very, very demanding. And I graduated. He graduated with honors. I just graduated because my priorities were more towards the family, and I studied when I could.
Right.
His priorities were more towards school, and he paid attention to his family when he could. So, but
what were your majors in?
I started out majoring in English. I was still going to be an English teacher. I was not still wasn't looking at the military, but in the years between high school graduation and starting college, I had talked to the Navy about enlisting in the Navy. And it just, it got messed up. The recruiter didn't call me back. And a couple of years later, I got pregnant. And then the recruiter called back. And, of course, they weren't interested now that I was pregnant. And so, yeah, I lost my train of thought. Oh, so when I was going to go to college full time, my husband said, "Well, you know, you were interested in the Navy. Why don't you look at ROTC and possibly becoming an officer?" So I went in and talked to them, and they said, basically, just sign up and take the classes. There was no commitment. No, you just took the classes for 2 years and then decided if it was the right thing for you. So I did. And made an A in the first class I took, which meant that these were easy classes, and just decided to keep on taking the classes because they were easy. It was going to be an easy A and could keep my GPA up.
These were the ROTC classes,
right,
you mean? Okay.
The ROTC classes.
Which ROTC was it that you were going to?
It was Air Force ROTC. The university only offered Air Force and Army, and I suspect that Air Force was the one I got to first. You know, they just happened to be in the front of the building and the Army was in the back or something like that.
Not a conscious choice of which one you're going to?
It absolutely was not a conscious decision of one service over another. So, I took the classes. I enjoyed it. I did well in it when I was given opportunities to take leadership positions. I did well in those positions. So it just seemed like a good fit for me when the two-year period was over and it was time to make a commitment. I was ready to sign my name and go ahead and make a commitment.
Now, about what year are we talking about when you first signed up for the ROTC?
It would have been 80-81 time frame when I first signed up for classes. 82 was when I would have had to make a commitment. And then 84 was when I graduated and was commissioned. So...
So when you with 82, when you had to make a commitment, what kind of a commitment did you have to make?
Basically, because I was not going to be a pilot or a navigator, I was saying that if they continued to train me, I would give them 4 years after graduation.
But you didn't know exactly what it would be in?
You had absolutely no concept whatsoever what it would be in. I had changed my major by that point to linguistics. And so I had a suspicion that I might be put into intel, which is not something that I wanted to do. And in fact, I told them I did not want intel.
Why didn't you want intel?
Very naive conception of the risks and dangers of knowing secrets. I didn't want to know any secrets. Just give me a job to do where I don't have to know anything that somebody could threaten my family to make me divulge some information.
Well, these were the Reagan years, so...
Yes.
It was pretty, you know...
Yeah, so I just didn't want to be have any part of that. Don't put any temptations out in front of me. Just let me do my job. So, and I did not go into intel. They selected me for transportation, and I didn't have a clue what that was either.
Right.
But and it was not something that I'd asked for. I had asked to go into education or possibly hospital administration. And the Air Force, in their infinite wisdom, decided that those weren't the right places for me to go to and selected transportation, and I would not change that decision at all. I had a blast for 20 years of logistics, or over 20 years of logistics and transportation. And it was a good fit for me. So
they must have known what they were doing somehow, huh?
Somehow.
Or the needs of the military just came pointed in the right direction for you.
They put a lot of people into transportation that year. So maybe they were just short in that career field.
Yeah.
Or maybe because I hadn't focused my studies on anything like engineering or things along those lines. It was just okay, here's a name. What's the next career field that's open?
Now, when you're thinking about, so you have a family, you're going to college, or my husband's going to college, or I guess he's graduated too around the same time.
He graduated 1 year before I did.
Okay. What did you have a certain expectation of what you thought when you made your commitment to joining, you know, saying, okay, I'm going to commit to 4 years when I'm done graduating? Did you have an idea of what that might be like?
Some idea. Only because, remember, my husband had been in the Marine Corps when we got married. So I had been a military wife. And basically he got up and went in to work early every morning. And he came home every afternoon. He never brought work home. And he did a lot of paperwork and communications and things like that while he was at work. So I had kind of a vision that I would be getting up early, going to work every morning. The difference would be that that I would actually have decisions to make, where he was very junior enlisted, and since he got out after his first term, did not get a whole lot of depth or responsibility or supervision time. I knew I would be a supervisor, so I would be making decisions that affected people's lives. And that I would be taught what I needed to know to do my job.
You felt pretty comfortable about that?
I did. Yeah. I did. We knew that we would go to tech school, where we would get into regulations, and they would tell us, you can do this and you can't do this, and we would go to work knowing that we had to maintain a certain standard and go from there.
Now you said, what was it? Were you influenced at all by the fact that your father had been in the military and your husband had been in the Marines? Was that, do you think that had any influence whatsoever in you deciding on this course? I mean, you said he had said, your husband, Carl, had said, hey, why don't you check out ROTC?
Right.
But beyond that, I mean, you're...
And my father had been in the Navy. My brother had been in the Navy.
That's right, your brother.
My uncle had been a pilot in the Army Air Corps. Basically, what that did for me is it took out some of the mystery that might cause a fear of going into the military. People that I knew and loved had done it and had survived it and had even done well at it. So there was no mystery out there. You know, gosh, once I get into this, I'm trapped. There was no sense of that. And my husband and I had talked about it, and basically that's what people do when they graduate from college anyway. They go work for a corporation of some kind, and mine just involved wearing a uniform and took out the decision-making of what to put on every morning. But it was still a corporation, if you would, that you had the chance to grow in and develop an expertise in and do well in if you chose to do that. So for me, it was not, there was no mystery to it. It was just something that, it was the next step.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that I was going to do and I was going to do well.
Well, did you have any, was there any, what were the reaction of like your family and friends to you deciding to join?
I think I became my grandfather's favorite grandchild. At that point, after I graduated, before I went on to active duty, I went to visit my grandfather, who promptly announced that we were going to an American Legion meeting and I was going to wear my uniform, my full uniform, keeping in mind that graduation was in May, so this was in June in Florida. Once again, like I say, about 20 miles from the Georgia border. It was probably 110 degrees. And the building we were in had no air conditioning. And I was in long sleeve service dress with a blouse on underneath it. I have never been so hot and miserable in my life. And I have never seen my grandfather be so proud. So it was worth it.
Excellent.
So my mother thought it was a great idea. She always knew when I was growing up that I would do something unusual. She just didn't know what, so I'd answered that question for her. My brother was going into the Navy was in the Navy at the same time. So he didn't even think anything about it. Okay, this is what Amy's up to now. was about it. My husband obviously was fully for it. His mother wasn't, I don't think she was overly thrilled because she knew we were leaving New Hampshire and we're going to travel and maybe thousands of miles away, and we had her granddaughter with us. So, but I don't think anybody, I think except for the fact that we were going to be separated from certain family members, I don't think anybody had any ideas about it except maybe being proud that I'd made that decision.
Excellent. Well, tell me about then getting to your first assignment, your first duty station. What was that like?
Okay. Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota. Why not Minot? And freezing's the reason.
You have a few cliches there.
they have an expression up there, and I think they at one point had it over the gate that only the best go north. And it was supposed to make you feel good about going there. I didn't know what to expect at Minot. Then I found out, and I really didn't want to go there. But in retrospect, years later, when I got selected to be a commander, I applied for the commander's position at Minot over all of the others. It was my number one choice. I didn't get to go. But I would have gone back there. Minot was somewhat isolated. It was a few miles out of town. But the town of Minot was very supportive of the base, having the military there. So there are some areas where the military is not necessarily a good influence or welcomed by the local populace. There we were. Because we were somewhat isolated, you develop a sense of family. You no longer have your parents or in-laws or cousins or anything like that around. So your next-door neighbors become your best friends. The people that you work at the office become very good friends. There's a lot of social activity.
What kind of social activity did you
do? Well, when I first got there, they had had an inspection and did not do very well on the inspection. So there wasn't a whole lot of social activities when I first got there. But they then had another inspection, did very, very well. And I can remember the wing commander telling us how disappointed he was in us, because he had told us when he got there that we were going to work hard and we were going to play hard. And he had not seen any playing yet. So our first sense of quote-unquote playing was we had a toga party. And that was very interesting. But there would be large gatherings. They were very big on hails and farewells. When new people were coming in, they were recognized and hailed into the group along with their families. And then as people were scheduled to leave, they were given farewells along with their families. And those were great events to attend, because everybody was generally very, very happy to meet the new people. A little bit of sadness saying goodbye to the ones that were leaving.
Can you describe how one of those might have been to somebody who's not familiar with?
Okay. It's a party like any other party, a lot of people coming together, but then somebody who was running it, sometimes it would be the wing commander if it was a base-wide one, or somebody, could be a squadron commander if it were a smaller one, would recognize and call for the people and the families that were all leaving. And all those people would come forward, and a lot of times they'd be recognized by giving a small gift or something along those lines. And generally, especially at Minot, it would be something that was related to the local area. I still have an arrangement of wheat that I was given, because around North Dakota there are wheat fields. So that would have been something that would be appropriate
symbolic
to give,
mm-hmm,
give somebody. And so all these people would, you now knew who was leaving the units, who was going on to another base, and you were told where they were going and what their new job was going to be. And it was kind of an indicator, especially for the younger officers or the younger people that were there, that, okay, so this could be your next step in a year or two when it's time for you to leave. So there was a lot of excitement about that. Then they would announce the names and welcome forward all the people who were just arriving and their families, tell where they had come from, what job they had done there, and what their new job was on base. And this gave you an indication of some of the people that you were now going to be working with in offices that you dealt with every day on a professional basis. So it was good for everybody, good for those people who were going to be staying there a little while longer. But it was also a good way to make people feel welcome, mm-hmm. and to recognize people who had done a good job for the 2 to 3 years that they had been on a base.
Well, can you talk a little bit about your job? What was your job like when you first got to mm-hmm. Minot?
Brand new second lieutenant, didn't know anything about transportation, but I've always been the type that would ask questions. You know, if I don't understand something, I had walked into a base, into a command, where you did things, everything was written in black and white. Things were right or wrong. There weren't a whole lot of decisions to make. You had to know the regulations. And I was the type that always said, why do we do it like this? And the answer quite often was, because we always have. Because it works. And sometimes I wouldn't see efficiencies. So I just kept being that little voice that said, why? Why does it have to be this way? I was lucky I had a boss that encouraged that. He was not a career transportation officer. He had been a navigator. Navigator? Pilot. I think he was a pilot. And he could no longer fly because of health reasons. So they had put him into transportation. And he thought that it was pretty neat that I just kept saying, why do I have to do this? Why do I have to do this? When everybody else was just kind of marching along because they were told to. As I mentioned, they'd had an inspection and had not done very well. And I could do nothing that wasn't right at that point. Anything I did, if I changed a piece of paper from white to purple, that was good because it was changing the bad stuff. It didn't make a whole lot of sense, but it gave me the freedom and the creativity that I needed to flourish in my job. And I found out a few years later, I very quickly became known as the person who would always ask why and look to change things.
Sometimes there's a perception that the people who are in the military are only the type that are going to follow.
Right.
Whatever the, you know, I wouldn't be a type like you, Amy, that right. would question things. What do you think? What do you think about that?
I think maybe at one time it might have been like that a lot. You probably did have an awful lot of lemmings within the military, but I think that in the quest for efficiencies, doing things the same way you've always done them does not get more efficient. So I think the military now encourages much more for people to look at the way things are and question, why does it have to be this way? Why can it not be better than this way? Mm-hmm. So, but I don't think it's always been like that. I just didn't know how else to be. And my boss had no inclination to stop me. Mm-hmm. So, and I was very lucky in that way. I did meet up with him later, and he did ask me if I was still asking why.
Well, so, what was your husband doing at this time?
He was playing Mr. Mom. We had a daughter at home. She started kindergarten at Minot, and he was staying at home with her an awful lot. He did eventually get hired on. He did a lot of things, a lot of our career, in the recreation area. He worked at recreation centers. He worked on golf courses, did various jobs along those lines. Eventually, when I became a commander, he became director of outdoor recreation, and set up trips for military people and their families to take in the local area around Nellis Air Force Base, so that because there's so much more to Las Vegas than the casinos, and you have the pleasure of getting to know that if you're on the Air Force Base, because they specifically try to introduce you to things like hiking or going to Zion National Park or going to the Grand Canyon and things along those lines. All of that's within easy driving distance and so much more wholesome than the casinos and so much less expensive than the casinos.
Yeah.
So true. So he had that job. He worked at the recreation center. He called bingo. He worked at the NCO club and called bingo. He flipped burgers. He's done just about every job there is to do in the area of recreation
mm-hmm.
on a base.
How did he yeah. feel about that? Because what was his degree in?
His degree was in forestry,
mm-hmm.
which caused us a little consternation when we found out that we were going to Minot, because the joke is that the state tree is a telephone pole in Minot. They tell guys that are getting stationed there that they're going to love it, that there's a girl behind every tree. And yes, there is a girl behind every tree, but there's no trees. So he just basically left forestry behind and in fact has not worked in forestry in the 23, 24 years since he graduated. So caused him a little bit of frustration to have spent 4 years studying and graduating with honors to learn something that he never used, but he has developed other talents in other ways. He's worked budget management for a major headquarters in Japan and things along those lines. So he still found niches to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't always. The frustrating part is starting over, where when we would get to the end of 3 years, I was going to a base and walking into a job that was sitting there waiting for me, had my name on the chair. He was getting there and then looking for what he was going to do at this particular base.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that meant starting at the bottom tier.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Proving himself again.
Proving himself again, sometimes not starting at all. Hiring freezes, you know. When we got to Tinker Air Force Base, the military had just initiated a big hiring freeze. You weren't going to hire any more civilians. So that meant that he wasn't going to work on base, and he had to find something off base. And breaking into a new community isn't always that easy, depending on where you are and what the economy there is like.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been frustrating for him. So, but he's at work now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we're sitting here. Well, what after Minot, where were you headed?
When we started coming up on time to leave Minot, I turned in a dream sheet. You always turned in a dream sheet, told the military where you'd like to go, and then took your chances. My boss was looking at leaving about the same time I was, but he knew the system much better than I did. I thought all you could do is turn in your dream sheet and then sit and wait for them to tell you something. He told me, why don't you call and see what's going on? I can do that? So I called, and they said, chances are you're going to go overseas. We have 14 officers coming up for assignments, and we have 16 slots that we need to fill. So you are probably going overseas. So I was happy. I reported back to my boss. I'd done what he said, called. And he goes, not good enough. If they know they have 16 slots to fill, they know where they are. Call back, find out where they are, tell them which one you want, and let's see what happens. By the time it was all done, I had my assignment before he had his. And I was going to Yokota Air Base, Japan. Did not know anything about Japan. But the obvious next move, I had done ground transportation at Minot. A transportation officer has got to get into air transportation. So I told them I'd like to go to Japan so I can do air transportation, and that's where they sent me. And once again, we were at the right base at the right time, because we absolutely loved being in Japan.
Well, before you tell me more about Japan, I'm curious about, how did you know that you needed to do air transportation?
Basically, when you go to tech school, mm-hmm. you know, they tell you in tech school that you need to have a balance of air transportation and ground transportation, because you're expected to be knowledgeable in these things to get promoted. And if you only work one, eventually you're going to stop getting promoted, because you're not as usable, you're not as valuable to the military.
Was that something, as a officer, that you know you're cognizant of, that in the as your career progresses, this like the steps you need to take or certain slots you need, is that something that someone is advising you on?
Usually you have your boss, your squadron commander, will advise you on it. You got told all of that while you were at tech school. You were told what the obvious next moves are. Obviously, there's some variation in it. But you knew that by the time you were being considered for major, you had to have accomplished certain things. Mm-hmm. You could take your own road to get to each of those things, as long as you got them all done by the time you were coming up for major.
So you're checking off certain boxes or something of that
nature? Yeah, pretty much. You have a checklist, and you know what gates you need to make, if you want to call it that. You know what hurdles you need to jump over. And it's just like running a race.
Do you have some help along the way to jump over those hurdles with other...
You do. It's gotten better now, because they require commander's input for assignments. When I first went in, if anybody was calling my boss and asking him anything about my next best move, I don't know about it. I certainly never heard about it. Now it's required they actually have to sign off on your sheet before you turn it in. So, yes, they're advising you. And they actually did have the opportunity to say, no, I don't think this person is ready for this job at this time. Because there are those of us who aspire to great things and will apply for jobs that might not be the right time for us. Mm-hmm. We might not be ready for it, but we don't fully understand the job. And mm-hmm. there are times when you think you can do anything.
Okay. Well, I've heard, too, that some women have said that they were assigned a job that they never thought that they could do, and yet the people who were pushing them knew that they could do it. And so they got a lot of confidence from, you know, being put in a job where they maybe didn't feel so secure about it, but then once they got in it, they realized they could do it.
Right.
Because they had somebody behind them that was kind of propping them, or maybe even pushing them.
Well, and going from ground transportation to air transportation, the two are so radically different that when I got to Japan, I had absolutely no knowledge that had prepared me for that job there. It was now, 2.5 years since tech school, so anything that I learned about air transportation there was gone. I had done very well in ground transportation, but what I was being sent to do was to get in a truck and run from airplane to airplane, making sure that they were configured properly, that when the cargo was being built up into pallets, which is how things go through the air transportation system, that those pallets are being built properly. I've never seen a pallet in my life. And now I'm supposed to be the boss, and I'm supposed to be running the show and telling people when they're not doing their job right, when they've got so much more expertise. Yeah, it was a little unnerving for me. I dreaded the thought of going out onto the flight line, because there were places where you could enter it, and if you didn't enter it at the right place and you went over a red line, police were coming at you with guns. That was intimidating. But you just went out and did your job, and you very quickly found out that just like at your first base, You know what's right. You know what's wrong. You just apply the standards and go on with the job. There were people willing to teach you those detailed things that you didn't know, and what you just needed to do was be willing to learn.
Hmm. Did you ever step over the red line?
I did not, but I've watched other people do it. I did watch other people do it.
Well, tell me a little bit more about Japan then. How did you enjoy that tour?
We did enjoy the tour. My husband found a very good job working at the headquarters in budget management, and he was there. He was the headquarters supply person, first name basis with general officers and things. So he knew more of the bigwigs on base than I did because of his job. We met a whole lot of people. Again, it was a rather secluded type assignment. You know, you weren't going back and forth to visit your family all the time because you had the whole Pacific Ocean to fly over to get home. So you developed really, really close friends, really good friends. And some friends that we made there, we are still friends with to this day, still keep in contact with. The job was very interesting. Strange hours. We worked 12-hour shifts, so it was a really long day. But you generally worked 3 days on, 2 days off. So you were having a weekend after 3 days of working. So it took a little getting used to, but it was something that was really fun once you did it. We took the opportunity to travel all over Japan, went to places where they had not seen Caucasians except for missionaries. Took the kids to see these places, got my older daughter involved in Girl Scouts, where she was actually going to Girl Scout camps with Japanese Girl Scout groups there too, and things.
Do you remember some of the places that you went there in Japan, like that were like that? You said they hadn't seen a Caucasian.
We went down to Beppu, which is a tourist place. It's not on the main island. I can't remember the name of the island that it was on. But it's got hot springs, lava, heated hot springs, and things like that. We went to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, both. One of them we went to accidentally. We got lost. The signs on the roads in Japan are not in English. They're all in
imagine that
in the Japanese kanji language, and so we would navigate our way down these streets with me looking at the map and my husband driving. By the way, we're keeping in mind you're driving on the left side of the road, and your steering wheel is on the right side of the car, not the left side of the car. So, difference in driving. But I'm looking at the map, telling him we're now looking for a sign with a man walking a dog that only has three legs. And the man has his hand up in the air. And that's literally how we looked for signs for the exit that we needed to find. obviously, we got lost once in a while. And that's how we wound up in, I think it was Hiroshima. We didn't intend to go there. And in fact, I was pregnant and really did not want to be there. But we wound up there nonetheless. And, so we had all sorts of adventures. My husband did scuba diving a lot while we were in Japan, so we had relationships with people that had nothing to do with the base, because we would go to these scuba diving places and make friends with the local people. How we did that, I don't know, because we didn't speak any Japanese, and they didn't speak very good English, but when you have something in common like scuba diving, and or children. Hmm. You know, the children were a big barrier breaker when it came to making friends. We did have a baby while we were over there. She has Made in Japan stamped on her bottom.
Well, how was that, having a pregnancy in the military, in the service? What was that like for you?
Well, for me, because my job was out on the flight line, not a whole lot changed. I still got in the truck every day and went out on the flight line and got on and off of airplanes and did my job. It kind of came to a screeching halt, though, when I went on an airplane and the crew that was on the airplane had a heart attack because I was pregnant, and they were afraid that I was going to fall on their plane and get injured, and I didn't go on very many planes after that because my boss decided that I was probably beyond the point. I was probably 7 months pregnant at that point. Mm. So right about 7 months, they pulled me in and gave me a desk job and assigned me to do some stuff that that nobody else wanted to do anyway, but it didn't require me to go out on the flight line, no lifting, anything like that. But basically, you went to work at the same time every day, and you got off at the same time every day, and when it came time to deliver, you called in and said, I'm on my way to the hospital, and they knew you weren't coming into work that day.
How did you feel you were treated as a pregnant woman in the military?
I just never let it slow me down, so I never really focused on it. Mm-hmm. One of the negatives was that at that time, once you had the baby, you had 4 weeks of maternity leave. Now they have 6 weeks, but at that time it was only four. And the project that I was working on, the military does annual awards. Units submit giant packages with all sorts of pictures and write-ups and everything detailing all the great stuff that they've done over the last year. And some wise people at headquarters look at it and decide which unit is best and declares them the unit of the year. My job was putting together all these awards packages to submit, and they were due not long after the baby was born. So I worked through my whole 4 weeks of maternity leave. I was at work probably 30 hours a week instead of 45 or 50. And I had the baby. I mean, I would go into an office where I was not disturbing the flow of activities. Sit at, we didn't have computers back then, we had word processors. Sit at the word processor and do the wordsmithing and the editing and all the stuff that needed to be done to the awards packages. Tape pictures onto paper and get everything set up. I could do that in a back room with the baby right there with me and stuff. And the packages were all completed right at my 4 weeks of maternity leave ending. So I never saw my maternity leave. That was one big disadvantage. In retrospect, I let it happen. I never said, no, I'm not coming in, I'm on leave, this is my leave, you have to leave me alone. I never said that. So, in retrospect, it wasn't anybody else's fault but mine. But I didn't see it that way at the time, and my husband certainly didn't see it that way.
I imagine not. Did you go in uniform when you were doing this?
Most of the time, no. Most of the time, no. During this time, I was also put up as officer of the quarter, and I had to meet a board in my uniform. So, but that was luckily at about the 3 week point, so I'd had time to lose the weight and get back into my uniform like I was supposed to be. So, but no.
How'd you do in the?
Well, I wasn't selected as the officer of the quarter. But
that's nice that you got put up for it. That's pretty neat.
It is. I can remember one of the questions they asked me was, who was the dictator that was in Panama?
Noriega.
And I couldn't remember Noriega's name to save my life. I should have, because maybe I don't want to say this in this. We had a picture of him in our office that we used as a dartboard. And I could see his face just as plain. I just could not think of his name, which was very embarrassing when that's what a board asks you.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So.
Well, that's neat. So, okay, so you had a baby in Japan. You learned how to do air transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Your husband's got a pretty cool job. And what were you ready to move on when the time came up, or was there any hardship with that?
I was not ready to move, but I was not ready to move because in almost every unit you have a job that is a person called the mobility officer, and their job is to make sure that the unit is ready to go to war if that happens. Most people will never see it, or maybe today they will, but back then most people did a whole lot of preparation and then went on to their next job because nothing happened. I had been the mobility officer at Minot, and we never went anywhere. My goal was to become the mobility officer when I got to Japan. So after a year and a half, I guess, of running around on the flight line, they asked me if I could pick my next job, what would I want it to be? And I said, oh, I came here wanting to be the mobility officer. That's exactly what I want to do. And they gave it to me. So I was the mobility officer for the last year, little over a year that I was there. And I loved it. It's a job that is, it's just very rewarding because you know, you can see when people are prepared and you can see if you, especially if you walk into the job and they're not, you can see the progress if you do your job right. So I was in that job when it was time for me to move on. And I was not ready to move on because my next job, in all likelihood, was not going to be mobility. And I was in my element. I was right where I wanted to be. But that doesn't last. So they had a special program that they only selected 12 officers a year to do. So, you know, that meant that I probably couldn't get it, which meant that I wanted it. And so I applied for that. It's called the Logistics Career Broadening Program. And they, as far as I know, they still have the program today. It takes you to an air logistics center as a logistics officer and teaches you how the logistics centers work because they have distribution, they have maintenance, they have propulsion. They work on engines and airplanes. They have material management. So they have a whole lot at these air logistics centers that you will never see. They have warehousing. And normal bases don't have huge warehousings and supply parts for the rest of the Air Force. So I volunteered for the program and somehow got picked up for it, not sure how. So that took me to Tinker Air Force Base, Oklahoma. That was really a coup to get that job when they're only selecting 12 officers a year for it. That was quite an accomplishment. I was very pleased that I had even had the guts to ask for it. So we went to Oklahoma, again, living out in the country, and there was not the same kind of camaraderie at Tinker Air Force Base that we had seen at our first two bases. We became close friends with people in the neighborhood we lived with who were all civilians. Our close friends were not on base. We didn't have any close friends on base. That was a whole different
element. What do you suppose that was?
Well, for one thing, Tinker Air Force Base at that time had 17,000 civilians working on it and 7,000 military. So there weren't a whole lot of military people there. Again, the program that I was in had 12 to 15 officers at that base working in it. So you weren't in the you weren't sitting with someone, you weren't working with someone that was doing the same kind of job you were. We changed our jobs every 6 months, went to another one because we were there to learn the overall workings of the base, not necessarily to develop an expertise in any one area. So you didn't work with anyone longer than 6 months.
How long were you in training for that?
It's a 2-year rotation. You move every 6 months, and then the third year, you're supposed to go back to your area, transportation, unless you've got a good reason, good justification for going to another area. I went back into program management for my last year, and did make a couple of friends, you know, really good friends on the base, but a couple of good friends on base didn't equate to what we had at Yokota and Minot, where there was such a sense of family and you felt like you could know these people forever and never get tired of knowing them. But we became friends with neighbors, mm-hmm, as opposed to people that we worked with.
And you said Tinker's where your husband wasn't able to get a job in the...
He could not get a job. We got there, and 2 days before we got there, a hiring freeze had been imposed for all civilian hires. So what he did was because he had learned to scuba dive, he went and got a job managing a scuba store. So, which put him in management and taught him the retail store area, and he's very good at it, and he actually likes it.
Mm-hmm.
He likes looking for new and creative ways to make a store profitable,
mm-hmm.
while looking for things to supply to customers that they need and want.
Well, now your older girl, how old is she about now?
In Oklahoma, she was 12, 13.
Okay. Getting to be a teenager.
Right there.
And your younger one is only a few years old then. A
couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think she was 20 months old when we first moved there.
So how were you finding having a family in the military and making these moves?
Well, the younger one, of course, you know, had no concept of leaving stuff behind and things like that. One of the things that was difficult to leave behind is that at Yokota, she had a babysitter that it was her. She was the only child this lady took care of on a full-time basis. And we still send pictures back to this lady. She and her husband are now retired and living in Virginia. So we will probably go up and see them, even though it's been almost 20 years since she took care of Bethany. Now, at Tinker Air Force Base, Bethany wound up in a daycare center, which was a totally different situation.
Mm.
And Donna entered junior high school, where she was close to becoming a teenager, and all the teenager rebellion and everything else was setting in. But my job in the career broadening program, there's no overtime associated with that. So you're going to work in the morning, you're coming home in the afternoon, you still sit down for meals every night. There's no such thing as deploying. You don't have to worry about going to war because they are not going to pull you out of that program. So it was a very, very stable three-year period for us. My husband went back and started working on a master's degree. I started working on a master's degree there. My mother-in-law came out to visit from New Hampshire and started a trend of spending winters with us because New Hampshire's winters were so harsh. She would now come and live for 3 months with us, and which was really good because now the children are getting to spend time with their grandmother.
That's really neat.
Tinker was a good assignment. It was a very, very stable assignment. I learned a lot. It was very rewarding work. I was given projects to work on that could be completed in a short period of time, you know, mm-hmm. 4 to 6 months, and benefited the unit, taught me stuff, taught me who to coordinate with and things along those lines.
Hmm. So then what came next?
While we were in Oklahoma, we moved my dad to live near us. He was about 4 or 5 miles away because he had had knee surgery and was now confined to a wheelchair and couldn't take care of himself. My next assignment would have been an overseas assignment, and in fact, I did get orders down to go back to Japan, just to a different base in Japan, which would have been really, really good. But I couldn't take my dad to Japan, and relocating him to be near one of my siblings was proven to be very, very difficult. So I contacted the personnel folks and said, "Is there any way to get out of the assignment to Japan? I would like to stay stateside." And in the end, I wound up going to McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. But the job I was going to was a much better job, a much more promotable position than the one that I would have had in Japan. So it turned out to be
pretty good
for me anyway. So I went to New Jersey and went back into air transportation, and was now like the second in command in the squadron. And so I had several young officers working for me, along with a lot of enlisted people. But I was now learning a different part of the world, where in Japan I had learned all about the Pacific and what happened there and the cultures there and stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm now having to learn Europe and what Europe is all about, because that's where McGuire Air Force Base sends all of its cargo to.
Approximately what time was this?
This would have been 90... 86 to 89,
so we're 93, 94. So when the Gulf War happened, what were you? Where were you at? Were you in the?
Oh, when the first Gulf War happened, mm-hmm. I was still at Tinker Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. Tinker Air Force Base had been made into an aerial port, which it didn't last very long. It was like a 1 year thing. They decided that the program wasn't going to work. The concept was to have an aerial port in the center of the United States, whereas all of the aerial ports were on the coast, put one in the center so that somebody who's shipping something out of Texas doesn't have to truck it all the way to the coast. They can take it to a base in the central United States, and it would then fly mm-hmm. to where it needed to go from there. It was a great idea, but some of the statistics they used to justify it didn't work. My personal opinion is they also forgot to take into account that when you're opposed to something, you can make it not work. And the coast ports did not want this port idea to work. And it didn't in the end.
A little of politics and power play.
And bad timing, because Desert Shield, Desert Storm started at that point, mm-hmm. and as directed, all the bases in the central United States sent everything to Tinker Air Force Base, but the airplanes had not been redirected to Tinker. So literally, the commissary parking lot became a staging area for all this cargo that accumulated and sat for weeks and weeks and weeks without moving because there were no airplanes to put it on. It didn't work because of a number of reasons, but timing of Desert Shield and Desert Storm mm-hmm. had to do with a lot of it.
What did you think about what was going on at that time with that engagement?
Well, obviously there was a lot of support for it. Some of our jobs changed. The career broadening officers knew that we weren't going to be deployed. So we weren't in danger of... We knew what Scud missiles were, but we were never going to find out firsthand what they were. But because we were logistics officers and we have all this cargo sitting there, we then got... A lot of us got very involved at getting creative and figuring out ways to get the stuff out of here, or how do we marshal it differently so that the more critical stuff is accessible when an airplane does come in, as opposed to some of the things that can sit and wait.
Mm-hmm.
It was very exciting. Hours got to be a little bit longer, but once again, with airplanes not coming in, work until 11 o'clock at night has absolutely no benefit whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So our lives there didn't change a whole lot. We understood the urgency of the situation, but we weren't personally impacted by mm-hmm. it. Now, we did have some reserve groups and things like that there who were impacted, and obviously security forces and some of those units
mm-hmm.
were impacted. But our lives didn't change a whole lot at that time.
Okay. So you've got this new great job at McGuire?
McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey, as the port operations officer. And like I say, I got to know a whole lot about Europe, not by going there, but knowing what cargo I was sending there, what the needs were. I learned a lot more about hazard materials, explosives and corrosives and things like that, than I had known at Yokota, because while we ship things there, we didn't, I guess maybe the officers didn't get involved a whole lot. I was now in a different position, and it was my job to make sure that we were complying with all the regulations for shipping mm-hmm. hazardous materials and things like that. It was directly, mm-hmm. I didn't have to have the expertise. I just needed to make sure that the people who had the expertise were applying it.
Right.
How's that?
Well, you know that incident that happened with the nuclear weapons not getting... What did you think about that? I was thinking about that when that happened, and I was going to... I wish I could, I guess, for the recorder to talk about. What was it that exactly happened with the... They didn't get taken off the... didn't get... what's the term about?
It didn't get properly manifested.
Okay.
For one thing, they didn't have the documentation. When you ship anything on an airplane, you've got full documentation of darn near every screw that's mm-hmm. on that airplane is documented somewhere.
Something like a nuclear weapon would be pretty visible on a checklist, you'd think.
When that happened, my husband and I heard it on the news, and my husband just looked at me and go, how does somebody do that? I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't know, and I don't want to know, because that is, there should not be any way for that to happen. There are just too many checks and balances. You know, the right down to the air crew mm-hmm. being briefed on what's on their airplane mm-hmm. so that they know how to respond to an in-flight yep. emergency if it happens. The people who loaded it knew. Somebody else did a load plan for what was going on to that airplane. And while, they're sitting at a computer and just typing things away, they have to look at all the background documentation and the hazards and make sure that...
So it went through a lot of filters that apparently...
There were so many steps along mm-hmm. the way where somebody should have blinked and then screamed.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even imagine how it got to that point. I don't know if lackadaisical attitudes added to it or what, but I...
I'm
very glad I was not there.
Yeah. Well, you probably see things like that, though, because of the type of work that you did that was so detailed and so meticulous about tracking, right?
Right.
That, you know, that when you see something like that, you just have to wonder what went wrong.
Well, you know, the only thing that I can think of that would be more important than tracking nuclear weapons would be human remains. When you're shipping a dead body, you know, a person's body, a service member's or even their family's body, there is so much concentration on making sure that the proper reverence is paid. I mean, it's not just a paperwork type thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's how the casket is placed and where on the plane it goes and the documentation that goes along with it and how the... responsibilities and rights that the next of kin who may choose to travel with it are afforded.
Mm.
That's the only thing I can think of that gets more attention to detail than a nuclear weapon.
Mm. Interesting. So
I can't even imagine how that happened.
Yeah. Well, so you enjoyed your job at McGuire.
I did for the most part. I was only in it for a little over a year and a half when they decided that they were going to reorganize how they did training in part of the Air Force. And they relocated a school to Fort Dix, which is adjoined to McGuire. Fort Dix and McGuire share a runway. And so they took this huge school and decided to move it there, and one of the smaller elements of this school was the Air Transportation School. It had been in California up to this point. At that time, training for tactics was done in one place, training for security forces was done in another place, training for all this mobility-related training was done all over the country. And they decided to bring it all together in one building. Fort Dix, as an Army post, had, I don't want to say stood down. They didn't close, but they had stopped a lot of their former operations. And one of the things that was there was their big induction center. That is where all the people used to come into the Army through, was the big induction center at Fort Dix. Well, now that's just this big, empty building, a huge empty building. So the Air Force leased it and later bought it, I think, and turned it into this big consolidated training location called the Air Mobility Warfare Center. And because they were going to have a transportation school, they were going to have a transportation officer running the school. So I volunteered for the position. I don't know if I got chosen because they could save money, because I didn't have to move. I never changed houses. I just didn't have to drive quite so far to get to work. Or if I actually offered them what they were looking for in the position. But here was my chance to be a teacher. And so I jumped on it, and I got selected for the job. So for the last 2 years that we were in New Jersey, I was at the Warfare Center and running a transportation school, but also teaching in a different department. So
how was that?
I would say the best job I ever had, but I think every job I get to, I will say was the best job I ever did. It was a really, really good job.
Yeah.
Worked with a lot of expertise in a lot of areas, but specifically the instructors that were there in the transportation school. We had class instruction there where they would bring people for mid-level instruction. They'd already been to basic tech school, and now they were coming for some mid-level instruction. So we had stand-up in front of the classroom instruction. We also had computer-based training that was developed there. And so the people that were working on that had to have very specific expertise to know not just what people needed to know, mm-hmm. but how to present it to them in a way that they could understand it, but you're not standing up in front of them. You're not getting any nonverbal responses to see if somebody understands it. This computer-based training was put onto CDs and sent out to Air Force bases all over the world, and were made mandatory lessons that people could sit out and learn more about their specific job. And it included things, customer service was one, but dealing with hazardous materials and the documentation mm-hmm. was another one. I mean, probably 40, 50 lessons that these people were developing.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, can you talk a little bit about over time? So you went active duty in 84,
mm-hmm.
and we're getting into the 90s here, I think, right?
At this point, it was 95.
Oh, okay, so you've been in for about 10 years.
Right.
Can you talk about the way, first of all, your experience having gradually more and more responsibility in command, you know, command level?
Okay. My first job, my very first job when we were at Minot, when I first got there, I had three people working for me. That was it. And they were all staff sergeants and tech sergeants, no brand new airmen, because I had no expertise, therefore I needed people with expertise around me. My next job, there were a whole lot more people working for me, but I also worked with a chief master sergeant. And nobody could rival his expertise. So, again, it was a learning-type thing. This was vehicle operations. And it was a learning-type situation where, okay, I could be an officer, I could be stern, I could apply rules, I could fuss at people or whatever, but I was not expected to have the expertise. The chief had the expertise, and the other senior NCOs that were with him had the expertise. And the chief and I, our offices, were right next door to each other, and he never hesitated to come in and close the door and say, okay, here's something you better know, because if you don't, it's going to come back and bite you.
Right.
I actually went through the process of hiring a civilian in that job. Chief hired the civilian. I just signed the paper because he had the expertise. Left Minot and went to Japan, and as a duty officer running around the flight line, you have nobody working for you as far as actually reporting to you, but because you're the commander's representative when he's not around out on that flight line, everybody works for you. So it's a lot of responsibility without the, you don't always have the hammer to drop. When I finally did get into mobility at Yokota, I think I had 5 people working in the office. So at this point, lieutenant, junior captain, very few people working for me that are really working for me. Career broadening program at Tinker, nobody worked for me. That was purely learning and never had anybody I supervised. At McGuire, however, all of a sudden I found myself in a position where I had four units under me, and they had the smallest one probably had 12 or 15 people in it, and the largest one probably had 40 people in it. So a lot of people working for me there. I was expected to have a certain level of expertise, and a lot of reports, a lot of evaluations, a lot of appraisals to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like most people, I found the paperwork the most tedious part of the job. But once again, if you don't give somebody the appraisal or the evaluation that they deserve, their career is going to suffer. So as tedious as it may be, you have to do it.
What about with having to give a negative appraisal? Did you have to do many of those?
Not a whole lot. Some, but usually if, and I find this still today, usually if you've got someone who is performing poorly, they either need to be out of the Air Force, if they're making a conscious decision to do this, or they have not been given the right incentives or opportunities to improve their behavior, and they've gotten into a vicious cycle. A lot of times, if you'll get involved and help somebody see their positive points, even though right now the negatives are very impacting on their mm-hmm. life, if you will let them see that there's reason to improve.
Do you have an example that you could give on that?
We had a guy that we called Mr. 180 Degrees. He was a young airman. He didn't have a whole lot of expertise. He'd made some mistakes. Got yelled at. Some of his mistakes impacted doing the mission, so they negatively impacted other people, so he got yelled at some more. And it started a cycle where he honestly did not believe he could do anything right. And that was not going to turn itself around. It can't. And I got involved, and another supervisor got involved, and a civilian got involved, and basically told this guy there was no reason why he couldn't control his future. And I don't know who said something right, but over a matter of a month, I mean, we're talking weeks, we stopped seeing him be quite so reserved. Because, I mean, he'd stopped making any decisions. I'm not sure he was deciding what to eat in the morning.
Do you remember what his rank was around?
Senior airman?
Senior airman, okay.
I think he actually might have been demoted to A1 airman first class at one point. But he was not going anywhere because he was never going to show any incentive, because he was afraid he'd make the wrong decision about anything he decided. And somebody somehow said something right that got him to understand that he did have the capability to do the job that needed to be done. And it started out with small things like he would stay longer at work to make sure that a job got done when it was time to go home, he'd packed up his stuff and gone home. That would have been it. So we started to see a little bit more effort on his part. Evidently, he started seeing some successes which led to increased effort on his part. Like I say, within a few short weeks, his whole attitude had changed. And within 6 months, he had completely turned himself around and was now a role model that some of the younger troops could learn from. Eventually, I left the job where I worked with him and went to another job in a whole different part of the base, a whole different unit. And when I was told, you can come down and pick someone to come and work for you to do this, he's the person that I picked to come up to the office.
That's terrific.
Which then further...
bolstered his confidence.
Yeah, bolstered his confidence. Further suggested to him that maybe he might have a career doing this. But we didn't let him forget because we were calling him Mr. 180 Degrees. You know? So... things like that are pretty neat to see. But not everybody will respond positively to suggestions for improvement. Not everybody will take on responsibility when you assign it to them. Most people will. So,
Well, what about, so now you as a woman joining the military in 84, and then, I mean, I know we've gone, you go longer than 94, but even, did you see any changes as far as being a woman in the military, or even, female officer?
I'm sure they were there. I'm not sure I saw them. When I first got to Minot, I probably worked with more female officers than I did males. So I didn't know that it was unusual. And in 84, it probably was unusual. But I didn't know that, and I didn't see it. I was so focused on my job and making sure I was doing things right. I'm sure there were times when things happened that maybe wouldn't have happened to a male officer, but I just didn't see it. When I first heard of Dakowitz, I was in Japan, and they came over to Japan on a visit. And so the female officers, in fact, no, it was the female officers, were specifically invited to a luncheon. And they were asking us very pointed questions about our treatment and things along those lines. And that was the first time I knew that there was a problem. You know, they had issues, wanted to know how the daycare system worked, wanted to know about the recreation center, wanted to know about our promotions compared to male promotions. I didn't know that this was something I was supposed to watch. Life happens, and they made me aware that there were issues. So maybe there weren't issues. So, no, I didn't see a whole lot of difference. I was getting promoted. In fact, I worked with two male officers who were not promoted when I got promoted. So I can't say that I was not being promoted at the same rate as the male officers.
So you feel like you're treated pretty fairly?
I do. Maybe I just had good bosses.
Well, do you think there's something to that? I mean, not necessarily even as a woman, but just having good bosses.
I think for the most part, I had bosses that knew that the young officers working for them were going to be their replacements, and they carried that responsibility to make sure that those young officers grew up in a way that they wanted to be replaced by them, and they took that responsibility seriously. So, no, I don't think it became, there was a male-female issue that impacted me.
I remember one incident we talked about last time.
Okay.
Do you think that was a male-female thing?
I don't think it was on the part of the individual. Okay, the thing that we had talked about was I married my job.
Right.
And the only thing that could negatively impact on me was when somebody got in the way of my doing my job. And as a brand new lieutenant, I was given my orders, and a major contradicted my orders and released all the people that I was supposed to be controlling, and they all went home. And I was very upset, and I went away all by myself and cried, which is the way I released tension. And he wasn't, it wasn't good enough for him to have interfered and then just walked away. He came to find me and found me crying and put his arm around my shoulder and told me it was okay, and that when my boss had a problem with him, just tell him that the big bad major made me do it. I didn't, that just made me madder. But I didn't take that as a sexual thing. Okay, yes, I'll granted, he would not have put his arms around the shoulders of a male officer, but the male officer wouldn't have been in this back room crying either, in all likelihood. I do not think he intended it to be a sexual thing. However, it was seen by another female, by a female NCO, who reported it, and he wound up, the major wound up in front of the wing commander's office desk, explaining his sexual harassment, which just horrified me when I found out about it, because I didn't make the complaint and I did not interpret it as that. Other people did. Maybe it's just my nature that I choose to see that I will accomplish what has to be accomplished, and if for some reason I can't, it has nothing to do with me being a woman. It just has to do with the fact that I couldn't, for whatever reason.
So you were more upset that you weren't able to complete your task, is what...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. My boss told me to do something, and I couldn't do it. And that just, that infuriated me, because up until that point, I think in my career, I had never not been able to do anything mm-hmm. that I had tried to do. So...
Well, did you ever have any, when you were in the position of, you know, men or women coming to you with their problems, did you ever have experiences where you had to counsel people about sexual harassment or discrimination or any of those sort of things?
I did. The first time happened very early. We had taken an individual who was failing to perform in his assigned duties, and why we did this, I don't know, but we did. We put him in charge of the dorm. He was now going to be a dorm manager. He couldn't drive taxis and he couldn't do paperwork, so he was going to be a dorm manager. Well, there was a young lady, now he was married, this young man was married. There was a young lady in the dorm that he found very attractive. And for whatever reason, he let himself into her room one day, and she was laying on her bed, and she was very upset about something else, totally unrelated, and he sat down on the bed beside her, and he rubbed her back and consoled her. Now, from everything I was told, both his testimony and the young lady's testimony, it never went any further than that. She was not in our unit. She was in another unit who didn't have their own dorm, so some of their people were spread out over other dorms. Her commander was very upset and felt like he had sexually accosted her. I read her statement. He never touched anything but her back, but he did sit on the bed beside her and rub her back. And yes, I had to call him in and let him know that his behavior was absolutely unsatisfactory, and he was fired as the dorm manager. There were no charges pressed or anything like that, but it was my job to make sure he understood that this was inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there have been male, female, but that's, in his case, well, he just wasn't very bright. But in his case, I think it was triggered a lot by... he found her very, very attractive, and now she was crying and hurting over something else, and I think he got himself into a situation where I'm not sure he could have resisted it if he tried. But that was difficult.
Well, that reminds me of another thing that you had talked about. It was really interesting how you talked about, we talk about males discriminating against women, but you had mentioned something at that one time about how women use their sex, I guess you could say, or gender, to get their way.
Okay. I think the question was, have you ever been aware of women, myself or others, mm-hmm. using their gender to promote their position or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And I wished I'd told that story a little bit differently when I answered the question before. Because, yes, I'm aware that that has been done.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a boss one time tell a very interesting story about tools and toolboxes.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a set of tools to get a job done. And that the tools may be, it may be something as simple as your height. If your job involves having access to things that are well over your head or things along the, it may be something as simple as that. But it may be specific knowledge that you have. It may be your background. It may be your gender. And if your gender is a tool that you can use to get the job done, you would not be doing your best in your job if you did not use it. And I do know women who use gender to get their job done. Whether they related well to other women and got other women who worked underneath them to perform better because they aspired to be like this person, that's still using your gender. You know, no matter what you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's, how do I say this? If it is appealing to men who may see you as weaker or less able, and they then put out extra effort to help make the job get done because they perceive that they're going to get less input from you.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get people to input more, to put out more effort, by all means do it, because that means that they were capable of it to begin with and they should have done it to begin with.
Well, do you think that gets into anything with, oh, say the issue of combat, you know, and men and women in combat together, that it wouldn't work because the male would be protecting the female or something like that? Do you think that's...
I think there's always a potential for that to happen. But I can also say that a lot of the women that I know of in the military who were successful because they put in 150%, because they felt like they had to put in extra effort. And I think that you will see that in combat as well, that you will see women who are very much aware that they're perceived as being weaker or less, and therefore they have to try harder, have to work harder, have to put out more to be perceived as doing the same amount.
Mm-hmm.
So they will. Is that okay? Sure. If that's what it takes for them to reach their full potential, if 150% is their potential, then they should be doing 150%.
Well, there you go. It's interesting the way that you have articulated that, I think, is interesting. Because I think it's... You're talking about the potential someone can reach.
Mm-hmm.
And so I appreciate that. So, mm-hmm. So where were we in our last phase? I forget where...
Okay,
let's see,
McGuire. The transportation school.
That's right.
Working with a lot of experts. It came time to start thinking, but we were at McGuire for 4 years, actually.
Okay.
2 years on the base and then 2 years at Fort Dix. And obviously it was time to move on. Although at that time, we were in a period where you didn't have to move. They were letting people stay and homestead. But I had a general officer that I worked under who, no matter what the current feeling was, that you could stay and homestead, that was not in the best interest of anybody's career. So while the Air Force rules said you could, the general was there saying, you're not going to do it on my watch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which was exactly, looking at it, hindsight's 20/20. Okay, looking at it from the perspective I have now, he said exactly what needed to be said and did exactly. He was going to give up expertise, but he was going to keep people's careers moving.
Mm-hmm.
Is
that how you felt at the time?
Not necessarily. He did everything he could to get people good jobs out of that unit because we had been very successful at standing up that brand new school. And so he gave us the support that we needed. If we told him we wanted a job, unless he really felt like it was wrong for us, he was going to make phone calls and do whatever he needed to do to get us that job. I wanted to go back into air transportation. The school that I was running was an air transportation school. And the job that I wanted was not going to be made mine. The general got involved, and eventually I was offered the job. But up front, the answer was no. You are not going to have this job. They wanted a pilot or navigator, and they wanted a male. No female had ever held that position, which, of course, made me want it that much more. I had not pinned on major yet. No captain had ever held that position, ever. It was more senior majors and lieutenant colonels, which made me want it all that more. So but I wasn't going to have it, so I went looking for another job and eventually got accepted into special operations at the command level, which I had no idea what that was. And I thought where I was going was at their area of operation was South America. And it turned out that special operations was predominantly male career field, and the area of operations was the Middle East and Africa. So now I was going into a job that I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I had never deployed at this time. So operating at a remote site where I was responsible for taking care of people and making decisions without any area of comfort, any stability around you, I was just going into a whole new world. I did fine at the job. I quickly found out that when you deploy, you just look at the situation and you make a decision that fits the situation that's there. It's not any secret wisdom. It's not any God-given holiness that makes you do it right. And it's not even something that you can study up for ahead of time. You just have to look at the situation, just like parenting, and make the decision that fits the situation at hand. So I went to Florida, to MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. And I very quickly started deploying to places like Gutter, is how we said it, Qatar. I spent several months in Bahrain, went to Kuwait, spent a lot of time in Kenya, and a lot of time in Egypt. Learned a lot, probably learned a lot about myself. This was probably the most fearful time of my career.
What years were you doing this?
This would have been 96 to 99. So okay. Very, very early 96 or late 96 to late 99.
Mm-hmm. You're out of your comfort zone.
I was, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have said it better. I was so totally out of my comfort zone. I had no expertise, and yet I was being looked at to be an expert. And people's lives were depending on me. I was now responsible for setting up places to sleep, food, all of this stuff for people who were deploying to an area where I'd never been to this place before in my life. I had no idea where I was going to get food from or beds or anything else.
So you were like the logistics behind the special ops.
I was.
Okay.
More for the headquarters, except that when the Army units, and the Rangers, the special ops people, and even the PSYOP people would deploy, they looked at me. They would tell me what their needs were, but they looked at me to make sure that all this stuff was going to happen.
So it wasn't, it was a joint service?
It was.
Okay.
It was. The specific office that I worked in was joint Army and Air Force. I think we might have had one Navy reservist in there, but otherwise we were all Army and Air Force. But I spent a lot of time going to the Middle East. We lived in Brandon, just outside of Tampa, and I can't tell you a whole lot about the area because I was never there. My daughter obviously liked it because that's where she turned 18 and decided she wasn't moving anymore. And she still lives there to this day and
okay.
has been there for 10 years. I would not probably go back into that job, but I probably learned more in that job and had a very real sense of accomplishment in that job more than any other job that I've had.
Do you have any memorable story that you can tell us about it?
The PSYOP unit, we were going to an exercise that was in Egypt. And that exercise is such a big, massive exercise, you start planning a whole year in advance. And we had already had the first conference, which is a year out. We had the second conference, and we were now at the last conference, which is only about 6 months before the exercise started, maybe even 5 months. And the PSYOP unit that was going to participate, who had said they weren't participating, was told, yes, you are. And they're way behind the power curve. They don't even have tents to sleep in. You know, they haven't arranged for anything, and they don't know how to start. So we were in Egypt, we were in Cairo, at the hotel, and I had established when I was going to be in a certain room and for all the loggies to come and talk to me.
All the what?
The logistics people.
Loggies. Okay.
To come and talk to me to make sure that what they thought they needed, what I thought they needed, were one and the same. And I could let them know if there were any shortfalls. I mean, at that point, we'd been told there are certain things that weren't going to be available, so you're going to have to figure out some workarounds. So they didn't have any logistics people. Their operators were doing all of their planning. And operators are wonderful people, but they don't necessarily look at the big picture of support the way someone who's used to looking at it. They're looking at actual taskings and operating and getting the job done, but they're not looking at the mechanics that lead up to that point. They came into the room where I was and sat down very frustrated because they didn't want to be part of this exercise, and they said, here's what we can tell you. And, you know, they said a few things. I said, why don't you stop telling me and let me ask you, how many people are you bringing? How many of them do you think will be female? Because obviously when you're putting people in bedrooms to sleep, you've got to pay attention to that. Do you have access to tents? How much square footage do you think that you will need for your equipment and stuff? And they were able to answer all my questions. They just didn't know what I needed to know. And so I got the answers to all my questions, and then they said, so are we going to be able to come even close to this? You've told me what you needed. I'll get it for you. And they couldn't believe it. They just thought that this was just going to be an uphill battle, and I just basically said, go home and go to sleep, because I'll do the work. They started to leave the room, and then they turned around and said, are you busy tonight? Would you like to go sailing? One of them, his father-in-law, worked at the embassy in Cairo and had invited him and a couple of the people he worked with to go sailing on the Nile. And they were just so absolutely overwhelmed that I was going to make their job so easy. And this wasn't really, this was not any work for me whatsoever. If I'm going to arrange 50 tents, I can arrange 53 tents, you know, right. Which is kind of what they were asking for. And I said, sure, that sounds great. So they picked me up, and we went in the embassy's limo, which had, like, steel doors and, I mean, bulletproof windows, all this kind of stuff. We went there, went down to the Nile, got on a boat, on a sailboat, and ate pizza and drank beer while sailing down the Nile from one side of the Nile to the other. That is probably the neatest experience I've ever had in my life.
Oh, fantastic. Did you see any crocodiles or anything like that?
No, the Nile is an extremely filthy river.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very dirty. I can't imagine anything living in it.
Okay.
In fact, part of our conversation centered around all the immunizations that you have when you go over to the Middle East and Africa and stuff. How many diseases we would still come down with if we fell into the water. We're talking baby's diapers floating in it, you know, disposable diapers. You look at it, you know, it's a landmark. I know it's not one of the wonders of the world, but it's something that you learn about in history class and geography class, and we think of it as being such a great thing, and they just throw everything into it. I can't imagine it. But, you know, I look at how we treat the rivers and stuff here in the United States, and I'm not sure it's a whole lot better.
Maybe. Did you get to travel any more in the Mideast when you were there, leisurely?
Not traveling leisurely, per se.
Okay.
You might get an afternoon off to go do something. When I was in Bahrain, we went and visited some of the forts that were there that were built way BC, you know, and just to see things that are that old and know that, I mean, our history here doesn't even come close to the history that you have mm-hmm. in the Middle East. When I was in Kenya for an exercise, everybody was afforded one day off, and we were there for, I don't know, 3 weeks, something like that. And so the day that I got off, we went on a safari. Now, I had set up for these safaris to happen for everybody to go, but only like five or six people could go at a time. So my group of five or six go. And the driver told us to go back into the dining hall and get some rolls so that we could give them to the chimpanzees when we saw them. So I went and got a whole bag full of rolls, and he took us out. We saw lions. We were charged by a rhino and stuff. Almost lost one of our lieutenant colonels.
How did that go? What happened there?
She had a baby, but we didn't see it. I mean, we were in the jeep.
Okay.
We were in the jeep, and we're all taking pictures of the rhino. And the driver, through the camera, you kind of lose sight of what's happening big picture. The driver wasn't taking pictures. And the driver saw that this rhino is charging at the side of the jeep. And so he stomps on the gas because he's got to get us out of there. We had somebody on the back end, a lieutenant colonel on the back end. And luckily, his feet were tangled underneath the seat because we wound up grabbing his shirt and pulling him back into the truck because he was literally outside the truck, everything except the feet that were caught in the seat. He'd have been off if he hadn't been tangled in the seat.
Yikes.
So, pulled him back in. There are people who would say, he was a reservist and he was a lawyer in real life, so we teased him about it. Wouldn't have been a big loss. But we never, until the driver got out of reach of the rhino and stuff and we looked back, that's when we saw her baby. And we were just too close for her comfort to her baby.
Yeah.
So, but we saw warthogs. I got lots of pictures of warthogs. That's what I wanted to see. From The Lion King, I like the warthog. did not see, there were some things that we didn't see, I can't remember what. Oh, we did not see lions. We did not see any cats.
Oh.
There were no big cats that we saw, which, given the structure of my daughter's wedding, seems kind of
odd. Yeah.
But we did go to the place where the chimpanzees were. And so I don't know where I get this we from. I was throwing bread out to the chimpanzees and had forgotten a very basic thing about monkeys, about chimpanzees. You do not feed the females. That's for the male to do. If you're going to give them food, you give the male the food, and he will distribute it as he sees fit. I wasn't giving it to any particular chimpanzee. I was just throwing it. And the next thing I know, everybody in the Jeep in front of me is clearing out of the way because this chimpanzee has come up and over the Jeep and is coming after me. And he wants the rest of my bread. And I wouldn't give it to him.
Oh, no.
And I had to get shots because he bit my finger.
Oh, my gosh.
So I had a piece of bread in my finger, and he was going to take it. So he didn't bite my finger. He
bit the bread.
He scratched it with his nail.
I see.
But it didn't matter because you still have to get immunization or tetanus shots and stuff like that.
So you're protecting your bread, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. So we let him have the entire bag of bread. That was the end of that. He went and distributed it. So, but you know, you can't have these adventures every day. And you know, that was a very good adventure, and we got lots of pictures out of it, and memories that we'll remember for the rest of our lives.
That's pretty cool. So, how long did you do the special ops?
Almost exactly 3 years.
Yeah.
Got there in December and actually left there the 11th of January, so just over 3 years later. I actually left there before that because I was selected to be a camp commander, had asked to go back to Minot, but they had an immediate need and wanted a transportation officer at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. And because a lot of the other people that were going to be commanders weren't eligible to move yet until the summer, I was selected for that job. Air Force's largest transportation squadron. Scared me to death. But I got there. We flew out the day, 2 days before New Year's Day. So what, the 30th of January, 30th of December, because that was YK2.
Oh.
And nobody knew what the impact on airplanes and computers and everything else was going to be. So they actually flew me out early, and then we had the change of command, and I took over my squadron, I don't know, the 2nd or 3rd or something like that of January. And that was a really good opportunity. I had a deputy who was a retired supply guy, but he had been in that squadron, I don't know, for years and years and years, and had had more commanders come and go under him than I can even imagine. So I had all his expertise, all his continuity, because he knew the people in the squadron, he knew their capabilities, you know, the civilians that stayed behind.
Mm-hmm.
He knew war and factions that had existed for eons, and he knew who you could look to make the peace and everything. Had two good chief master sergeants there. One of them I still hear about. The other one decided to put in his papers and get out because they selected him for a deployment. He went and did the deployment, came back, and 2 months later was going to have to go. And his wife had I don't know if she had MS, something along those lines. And he could not be deployed all the time. So he put in his papers to go ahead and retire. And we knew we were losing him in about 2 months. And he was driving into work one day, and a semi ran into the back of his little sports car. And he was never the same again. They took him to the hospital and He never came back to work. It was very, very sad. And he was a phenomenal chief. He had taught me an awful lot, but more than that, I had second lieutenants that would work with him for 6 to 8 months. And I mean, we're talking brand new right out of tech school. And I remember being in those shoes.
Yeah.
And I think if you can take a brand new second lieutenant and have them work with a chief master sergeant, that's probably the best favor that anyone will ever do for them in their career. And he would sit down with them and he would explain decisions that he made and why he made them. He would make them get into the regulations and learn the rights and wrongs. I know on at least a couple of occasions when I would ask a question, okay, I understand what we're doing. I want someone to explain to me why we're doing it and why we can't do it a different way. He would sit down with the lieutenant, give them all the background, everything, and then make them come over and explain it to me. And he would sit there and listen to them. But he would make them, so they had to learn it in order to do that. And he was just so, so good at it. It was very sad. It was a big loss when he decided he was going to retire from the Air Force. I figured he was going to come back and work as a civilian somewhere.
Yeah.
And that just wasn't going to happen because his wife was now taking care of him. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking hardly able to walk at all. So, and that was probably going to be, there were some other complications that may well have shortened his life in the end. So, but that was Nellis Air Force Base.
Now, Nellis, you were at Nellis when 9/11 happened, weren't you?
I was. I thought the world would never recover from that. Obviously, life has gone on in a lot of places for a lot of people. I'm not sure I'll ever look at the world again the same. When you live on base, and in order to get to your house from off base, you have to go through a control point that you've got machine guns pointing at you. That's a life-changing type experience. There were no airplanes flying over Las Vegas for days, which is, I mean, it's Las Vegas. My daughter was, she was in junior high school. My younger daughter was in junior high school at the time. And for her and her friends to go on and off base was an unpleasant experience and stuff. You left for church on Sundays an hour before you needed to be at church so that you would be able to get through the gates of the base to be at church. It grounded people. It stopped people from taking life for granted because most people knew someone who had either died or come very close to dying because of the Pentagon incident. My secretary's daughter, one of her high school teachers, was killed. She was on one of the planes. Something as remote as that, to wake up one Tuesday morning and find out that everything is now different. You have entered an altered state that will never become unaltered again. There aren't any words to explain how impacting that one incident was.
Do you remember how you found out about it?
We were having an exercise on base, and when you have exercises on base, you're put into different scenarios where you have to do emergency procedures, and it's important that you know that you're doing an emergency procedure for an exercise as opposed to real world. So when you call somebody and give them a message, you make sure you say this is an exercise message. So I got a call saying that the threat level on the base had been changed, and it was the highest threat level we had. And he said, do you have any questions? And my first thought was, and I was still at home, I had not left for work yet. And my first thought, the first thing I said was, aren't you supposed to tell me that this is an exercise message? He goes, no, ma'am, this is not an exercise message. What are we talking about here? I mean, I had no idea. Our TV wasn't on. I don't watch the TV in the morning. And he goes, ma'am, I think you probably want to turn on your television before you leave for work. So I turned on the TV, keeping in mind we're 3 hours behind. So I turned on the television just in time to see the second airplane go into the building. And I couldn't believe it. It was like there was a science fiction movie on. So,
were they replaying it?
Yeah.
So
Shortly after they had replayed the second plane coming into the building, the first tower collapsed. Mm. And that I saw live. Mm. Because I can remember all the excitement in the announcers, the newscaster's voice. And I don't know, there are no words. I really thought it was an exercise that he was calling me about.
Mm-hmm.
And to find out that so fast we'd gone from having an exercise and complying with all the requirements to the exercise is done and we're in real world threat levels.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a smooth transition.
You mean for the military or for personally?
Both. Both. I mean, I think that the military on the overall just did it. I mean, you rehearse these things. That's why we have exercises. You rehearse these things. You rehearse going to higher threat levels and taking the appropriate actions. But for it to happen, and I think it happened rather seamlessly. We had a major catastrophe. The word went out, we were at a higher threat level because it could happen anywhere, and the word just went out and people just responded. It was very, very automated. But the horror of why we did it, maybe it was more of a personal experience, but it's hard to call it personal when it's shared with so many people. Because I think that everybody felt an awkwardness in the transition, even though our outward movements, our motions, our actions were what they were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
We were rattled.
Did you have a role in the war then, in Afghanistan?
That
happened shortly after?
Other than sending people over there and supporting training for pilots, because Nellis Air Force Base is a major training base. The pilots come there and fly on what they call the range. It's the area around Nellis Air Force Base that allows them to practice flying in a desert situation and things along those lines. There's a variety of geography and landscape there that allows them to prepare for realistic training.
Mm-hmm.
For when they go to Iraq and Afghanistan and stuff. So, we saw the training take on an intensity because all of a sudden people weren't just coming there to fly and then go have a good time in Las Vegas. They were coming there to fly because they needed to know how to do this flying.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things that happened was when these people come and train, there's so many. I mean, you'll have over 1,000 people there at a time. There's not enough room on base for them all to stay, so we have had contracts with hotels downtown. Now all of a sudden we're asking the question, what if something happened in downtown Las Vegas? What are we going to do with all these people? Because, I mean, obviously we're going to call them back to the base and we're not going to let them leave. Well, there's...
How do you house them and...
Yeah.
Things like that. Feed them. All that.
So we wound up coming with a plan to put them in hangars, airplane hangars, the gymnasium, how we were going to shower them, where we were going to get the porta potties to, you know, to allow them to do stuff. And the biggest glitch in the equation was for those people who come from bases that are close to Las Vegas, Arizona, New Mexico, sometimes they bring their families with them. What do you do if there's a major explosion in downtown Las Vegas, even if they're not hurt? They're coming to the base. I mean, guaranteed, if I'm there with my daughter, I'm not staying downtown. I'm heading for the base. So what do you do with that? So there was an impact that we had to plan for.
Mm-hmm. New questions to think about.
Right. Mm-hmm. That we'd never thought about before. Mm-hmm. And of course, then when we start briefing people on this and what we're going to do and how it's going to happen and, oh, by the way, don't bring your families. Now there's a resistance to it because it's an inconvenience.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So. Interesting. Well, one thing I forgot to ask you earlier was, at what point did you decide to make it a career?
I don't think I ever decided. I just, I was at Minot for 2 years. And Japan was a great place to go. Of course, I'm still under my 4-year contract then, so I really didn't have a choice about going to Japan. But coming out of Japan, I got selected for this really elite career broadening program. Well, I wasn't going to turn that down, so I went there. Well, coming out of there, I get selected to go be the second in command at the aerial port at McGuire. Well, I wasn't going to turn that down. That was a great job, and I was a mid-level captain at that point. You just don't find mid-level captains at a major aerial port as the operations officer. So it was all just, I liked what was coming next, so why would I not go? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I found myself at the 20-year point and still liked what was coming down the road, so I still just hung around for a little while longer.
What made you decide to finally get out?
My next job was probably going to find me in the Middle East, and not necessarily for a 4, 5, 6 week type thing, which is, I'd already spent a whole lot of time over there, but I'd spent short periods of time, and my next job was probably going to find me over there for a much longer duration. And that was not appealing to mm-hmm. me. I had a daughter who was graduating from high school. And so there was no longer that the drive to stay in to provide stability for her. She was moving out of the house and leaving home anyway. Mm-hmm. My husband and I wanted to travel together, right. Not just me travel. And do some things. Plus, I had been passed over for promotion to Lieutenant Colonel, and I don't know what the rules are now, but the rules were then, I could stay a major forever, or at least until the 24th year. Mm-hmm. So I really only had 2 more years to go unless I got picked up for promotion, but that generally doesn't happen. So I was at the end of a very good assignment. And
which assignment were you at?
I was in ROTC, mm-hmm. teaching ROTC, commissioning bright young lieutenants to go out into the field to be those lieutenants who would ask the whys, because I had taught them it's okay to say, why do we do it like this? And to say, to understand that because we've always done it this way was not necessarily an acceptable answer.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense, you've come full circle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I knew when I was taking ROTC 25 years ago that I probably would like to be an ROTC instructor. But it's not always the right next move. It takes you out of the mainstream. Okay, if you're a transportation or logistics officer, remember I talked about that career path, mm-hmm. and there are certain things that you're supposed to be doing before you get to a certain point. If you try and squeeze in something like teaching ROTC, you're throwing everything out of kilter,
mm-hmm.
and you may not be able to get back on track very smoothly, especially before your next promotion. So ROTC is quite often not the right next move. But for someone like me who's been passed over for promotion, I no longer have a right next move to get promoted.
Mm-hmm.
So it was perfect for me. It wasn't going to stop me from getting promoted, and it was something that I wanted to do. So that's, it was a good way to end a career.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've talked to other officers who felt the same way.
Yeah. Well, would you say that you had, your time in the military, do you think it shaped in any way who you were at all?
Oh, had to have. Had to have. I was so painfully shy.
Is that right?
Before I went to In fact, when I volunteered for the job at Fort Dix, running the transportation school, I volunteered for that job very conscious of the fact that the idea of standing up in front of a group of people and teaching terrified me, and this was going to force me into that arena and make me get over that fear.
Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. I had very little self-confidence. Going into the Air Force, and today it also allowed me to look at people differently. There's no good and bad people. People are different from each other, and that's okay. You know, it doesn't matter if you've got money or if you don't have money. It doesn't matter the male or female thing, the race thing, none of it, even in a package, in a person, none of it matters. What matters is whether or not that person is willing to live up to their potential, to do what they should be doing, and what they should be doing as determined by someone besides me. You know, it's not necessarily that they should be in the military. There may be something else that they should be doing. Teaching in a school. Driving a bulldozer. Directing traffic. Being a cop. You know, running a home daycare. But doing what your talents dictate that you should be doing with your life and doing it well. So it changed my way of looking at things. I was always going to be a teacher. I was always going to go to college. You know, life just had a predicted course, and that's the way things were going to go. And after 20 years in the military, I can see that even decisions about careers is not a right decision and a wrong decision. They're just going to change the course that you're on, and you stay that course and do the best that you can in the direction that you get led on. So.
And what is it that you're doing today, Amy?
I'm teaching. I'm teaching people who have dropped out of school for whatever reason at some point in their life and have decided that a high school diploma or a GED is important in their life at this point in time. So,
mm-hmm.
Now I'm helping them obtain that goal so that they can go on and stay the course that they're on.
That's really excellent. Was there anything in the 20, was it 20 exactly? That you
22.
Were? 22?
Well, almost 22.
22. So the 22 years you're in, women were able to do a lot of different fields. I mean, now they're flying jet planes, right?
Now the Flying Jets. Well, I spoke to you about Marcelita Harris.
Right.
General officer who, in her bio, if you read it, you will see that she was the first black woman to do, and I know that there were like four or five different things. Female maintenance officer, wing commander in Air Education and Training Command. So many things that she was the first at, but not the last, because it opened up doors for people to come behind her. Today, I'm not sure how many women are doing firsts anymore, because we've been given so many opportunities and have taken so many opportunities.
Do you think there's anything that women should not be able to do in the military or in, otherwise, I guess?
No, I don't think that... I think as long as it is something that a woman wants to do, I think she can and should do it. She should go after it, and I cannot see why someone would stand in her way. And I realize that society still looks at women as not being appropriate in combat-type situations. But... I don't know. I don't think it's legitimate anymore. So, we're certainly not running out of the world's population. So, to keep us around for breeding is not the issue anymore.
That's right. Well, we've covered a lot. I'm surprised, but you haven't even stopped for a drink.
Oh, that's okay.
A soda or anything. But is there anything that you want to add, perhaps, that we have not covered yet?
No, you know, I go back to stories that my last boss held or told. He would tell cadets. He's very good with stories that illuminated points while being fun to listen to. And I told you about the toolbox, that we all have tools. And he told that story, and he told it about a general who had a tool. He didn't know what it was, so he threw it in the back seat. And months later, his wife needed that specific tool to help her in changing the tire because of the awkward position the car was in and all sorts of stuff. But he just thrown it into the car. Tools that you don't think you're going to be able to use, just keep them around and they'll come in handy. But he told another one, and he used Skittles. And the cadets would all be sitting in the auditorium, and he passed around a jar of Skittles and said, you know, everybody take, you know, a handful of Skittles. And this jar circulated, and he waited until it got almost to the last cadet. And, of course, you know, a few of the cadets would eat a Skittle here and there, even though he hadn't said they could eat their Skittles.
Right, just take a handful.
And he'd say, oh, you're not eating any of those Skittles, are you? Did I forget to tell you that one of them has arsenic in it? And, you know, the whole room goes silent because the cadets don't know. And the first time I heard it, I mean, I was like, oh, okay, where are we going with this? Because I think it was a yellow one. Did anybody eat a yellow one? And nobody's making a sound. And he said, you know, we've talked a lot here about choosing right or wrong and doing things that are against regulations or against the rules. And, I mean, how many of you speed? Why do you speed? Most of you speed because you won't get caught. But you do get caught eventually. It's just like that Skittle. You can disobey the rules and think you won't get caught, but you will eventually. Somebody's got the Skittle with arsenic. Is it the first Skittle or the last Skittle? Is it the first time you break the rule or the last time you break the rule? The only way not to get the Skittle with arsenic is not to get any Skittles at all. And the only way not to get caught breaking the rules is not to break the rules. And he would generally present this when we had had a student get in trouble for something because they were bending the rules. And we talked about the thing about, in-state tuition and not really qualifying for it. An underage student who would drink because he didn't think he could get caught. And at one point, we had a rash of students getting caught drinking. We had one get caught who had bought alcohol for other students. And that then this thing, this story, the Skittle story, would come up about that time because it was real impacting for the newer students who had never heard about it. And it gave the concept of breaking the rules and getting caught, put it into a new perspective. I always thought he was very, very good about coming up with life lessons in a way that you didn't know you were learning a life lesson until you already had it in your head very firmly. I still keep in touch with him. I still exchange emails. He just had his first grandchild. And two of his three kids are now married. His younger daughter is also Bethany, born the same year my Bethany was born.
Right.
So we have a lot in common. His wife works with developmentally hindered adults. And they're just wonderful people to know. But the impact that he had on students' lives, I'll never forget that. And never lose sight of that. He's a really neat guy.
Excellent. It sounds like you made a lot of really good friends in the military.
I did.
Not even necessarily that we're in the military, but just through being in the lady in Japan.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. But I would advise anybody. My husband said this a long time ago. He would advise anyone to go into the military for one tour. Whether one tour is enough or not all depends on your perspective. I told you he left because he didn't see that he had anything else to gain. I never left because the next step was something I had to gain. And I never stopped looking at it like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the military can be very good for young people today. But whether or not continuing in the military is right for them is all going to be determined by their outlook and their perspective.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for letting me come and chat with you again today.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
I'll go ahead and click her off. Okay, Amy actually has one more thing she'd like to add. Go ahead, Amy.
You talked about making friends along the way. And I had mentioned earlier that I worked with two other female officers. There were three of us that worked very closely together. All three of us, years later, wound up at MacDill Air Force Base. Our careers had taken totally different turns. I was there now in special operations, working in a joint arena. One of them was now no longer working transportation at all. She was working humanitarian affairs, handling just about everything that was going on in Africa for humanitarian assistance that we were providing, the United States was providing. The other one had been a supply officer and had left supply and was a protocol officer. And she was now a lieutenant colonel. I was a major, and the other one that was working humanitarian had gone into the reserves. So her career path was a whole separate thing. It's different in the reserves for promotion and everything else. She'd taken a significant break and everything, too. So we're all now together in one place at one time again, along with the commander that one of them and I had, and it was very interesting to see the different paths that everybody had taken, even though we had all started out at the same base doing roughly the same jobs. So it just occurred to me that that was a phenomenon that doesn't happen all the time, But you make friends, and I still know where they are and stuff. And two out of three of us had children and raised children successfully with a career.
Do you think that says something about the opportunities that are presented in the Air Force?
I think maybe it says something about that prescribed career path.
Huh.
And the fact that you can follow it and be very successful, but you can deviate sharply from it and still be very successful. You'll just be going in a different direction than where you originally wanted to go. The opportunities are there no matter what direction you go in. You've just got to recognize them and take advantage of them when they present.
Excellent. So many paths.
Yes.
Really good.